From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
When you have facts in a case, and there are people who are trying to exploit the case in a violent way, you have to put the facts out.
From the attorneys, to the families, to the race merchants.
They all agree on at least one hypothesis. Many of the perpetrators are not local residents.
The number of outside agitators that are coming here causing all this ruckus in our community.
These are anarchists. These are haters. These are new Black Panther Party. These are zealots.
An outside agitator.
And that includes the racial provocateurs that go in and try to stir up trouble. And we all know their name.
Despite an ugly history of mistreatment that goes back four centuries to the arrival of the first enslaved African people in what is now the United States of America, whenever a public expression of discontent pops up, as we've seen in Ferguson, Missouri over the past days, the government and the media immediately place the blame on outside agitators. It's a tradition that goes back many decades to the uprisings in Harlem, Watts, Detroit, Newark, Chicago, and many more American cities. We'll take a closer look at that and more later in this newscast. The insurgent war against the Syrian government may have slipped out of the headlines over the past few months, but the killing there has not slowed, with the total number of dead now approaching 200,000. Patrick Maigwa reports from the United Nations.
More than 191,000 people have been killed in the Syrian civil war, according to the UN Office for Human Rights. The death toll compiled from several sources, including the government, is for the period between March 2011 and April 2014. The UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, Navi Pillay, however, says the death toll is probably an underestimate of the real total number of people killed during the first 3 years of the Syrian conflict. Ms. Pillay says failure by the international community to comprehensively bring the Syrian conflict to an end has continued to empower and embolden those responsible for the killings. Rupert Colville is a spokesperson for the UN Human Rights Office.
The High Commissioner says she deeply regrets that given the onset of so many other armed conflicts in this period of global destabilization, the fighting in Syria and its dreadful impact on millions of civilians has to some extent dropped off the international radar. The killers, destroyers and torturers in Syria have been empowered and emboldened by the international paralysis. There are serious allegations that war crimes and crimes against humanity have been committed time and time again with total impunity. Yet the Security Council has failed to refer the case of Syria to the International Criminal Court, where it clearly belongs. It is essential governments take serious measures to halt the fighting and deter the crimes, and above all, stop fueling this monumental and wholly avoidable human catastrophe through the provision of arms and other military supplies.
The report says over 85% of the victims documented were male. The killings of nearly 9,000 minors, including over 2,000 children under 10 years old, have been documented so far. The highest number of documented killings were recorded in rural Damascus province, with over 39,000, Aleppo 31,000, Homs 28,000, Idlib 20,000, Daraa 18,000, and Hama 14,500. Patrick Maigwa, United Nations, Geneva.
Meanwhile, the Obama administration appears to be preparing to begin the aerial war in support of U.S.-backed insurgents in Syria that it sought since 2011, only to be rebuffed repeatedly at the U.N. Security Council by a series of Russian and Chinese vetoes. The latest rationale for the airstrikes would be the group known alternately as ISIL, ISIS, and the Islamic State. We have this report from Press TV.
The United States says it is mulling over military action against ISIL inside Syria. This has been revealed at a press conference by the U.S. military top brass in what could be an effort to prepare the Americans for a new U.S. war in the region.
ISIL is as sophisticated and well-funded as any group that we have seen. They're beyond just a terrorist group. They are tremendously well-funded. Oh, this is beyond anything that we've seen. So we must prepare for everything.
This is an organization that has an apocalyptic end of days strategic vision, and which will eventually have to be defeated. To your question, can they be defeated without addressing that part of their organization which resides in Syria? The answer is no. That will have to be addressed on both sides of what is essentially at this point a non-existent border.
Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel says he would not rule out any possible action against ISIL, stressing that the Pentagon is looking at all options. Hagel says the Pentagon is pondering a long-term strategy against a militant group as it poses a threat to all U.S. interests around the world. Also, the chairman of U.S. Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Martin Dempsey, says defeating ISIL would require a variety of instruments, a part of which is airstrikes in both Iraq and Syria.
British MP George Galloway is perhaps one of the best-known British parliamentarians internationally, but an action by British authorities in reaction to a speech he gave recently about Israel may bring Galloway before Britain's highest court, where he could, in turn, place the State of Israel in the docks of British justice. We have this report from Press TV's Aisha Ali.
British MP George Galloway has been interviewed under caution by police over a speech in which he said his constituent city, Bradford, has been declared an Israel-free zone. The comments were made at a meeting in Leeds where Galloway was speaking on the latest Israeli massacres in Gaza and where he called for a comprehensive boycott of all things Israeli and encouraging the people of Leeds to do the same.
We have declared Bradford an Israel-free zone. We don't want any Israeli goods. We don't want any Israeli services. We don't want any Israeli academics coming to the university or the college. We don't even want any Israeli tourists to come to Bradford, even if any of them had thought of doing so.
Police said they interviewed a 59-year-old man under caution voluntarily following complaints made about the content of his speech. They said they'll pass the matter on to the Crown Prosecution Service, who will decide whether or not to charge Mr. Galloway, although what exactly he would be charged for still remains unclear. Mr. Galloway said he rejects any idea that the speech broke the law or incited racial hatred.
Israel are not a race. There was no part of anything that I said that was intended to incite hatred against anybody, race or not race. I don't think there's a jury anywhere in the land that would convict. So there's no chance of any charges being preferred, no chance of any court case, because we would win it. We would put Israel on trial, and for many weeks in the highest court in the land.
Attention will now shift to the Crown Prosecution Service and how they choose to handle the case. One criterion for prosecution to pursue the case is whether it serves the public interest, something many say is very unlikely in this case. Issa Ali, Press TV, London.
The first Russian trucks carrying humanitarian aid to eastern Ukraine have reportedly reached the city of Lugansk. Moscow ordered the convoy to proceed without waiting for further permission from Kiev. RT's Maria Finoshina gave this report from Lugansk Friday.
A thirsty and hungry city. Lugansk has been surviving without electricity or water for weeks now. A large number of the city's food enterprises stopped working a long time ago. Shops have closed. And all this amid an almost non-stop bombardment. We go to what used to be one of the biggest bread-baking plants here to find it out of service. The last loaf of bread came out of the stove 3 weeks ago. On our way to Lugansk, we saw many wheat fields burned to the ground. Locals say it was set on fire when shells landed there. Many are concerned that the region will not get this year's harvest and will face a deficit during the winter months too. While driving through the abandoned city, we come across a makeshift market. Sellers here are mainly from neighboring cities and villages, where the situation is not as dramatic as in Lugansk. Prices are through the roof. People come here to buy or exchange goods. Many are running out of cash, as all the payments have been cut off and banks shut down. Queues start forming early in the morning. While we talk, we hear the sounds of artillery fire. But locals seem to have learned how to live with this. When people learn that we are from Russia, they ask us about the humanitarian aid that our country is sending to eastern Ukraine. And it seems that finally there is some good news for these people.
The first batch of trucks carrying humanitarian aid for the people of eastern Ukraine has finally left Russia. Food, water, medicine and generators should now reach those who have been living in heavily shelled areas and surviving on dwindling supplies for many days already. but it will not be enough. And other 250 vehicles still remain on the border, waiting for their life-saving journey to start, while people's struggle continues.
Russia's permanent representative to the UN, Vitaly Churkin, said Friday there was both good news and bad news in Ukraine. He spoke at a press conference in New York at the United Nations.
I want to begin with some good news, and while I do that, I need to keep my fingers crossed. The good news is that, according to media reports, the first trucks from the Russian humanitarian convoy have reached the city of Lugansk, which has been besieged and shelled by the Ukrainian military for the past few weeks, therefore, for that reason, a humanitarian catastrophe broke out in that city of eastern Ukraine, as well as in some other cities, Donetsk and some other cities in eastern Ukraine, the population of which either trying to flee, mostly crossing into the territory of Russia, those who remain urgently require humanitarian assistance. On the 7th of August, Foreign Minister Lavrov sent a letter to the president of the ICRC announcing our intention to send a humanitarian convoy to eastern Ukraine. On the 12th of August, we received official information, a note from the Foreign Ministry of Ukraine confirming their readiness to receive that humanitarian assistance. Only after that, the humanitarian convoy started moving towards the territory of Ukraine, and they arrived at the crossing point into the territory of the country on the 14th of August. We had numerous, and on the 12th of August, we also informed the ICRC and the Ukrainian authorities about the content of the cargo. And on the 15th of August, the content of the cargo was also shown to the journalists who were on the spot. They randomly could be choosing the trucks they wanted to inspect, the journalists, and of course that additional inspection by journalists confirmed that there was no non-humanitarian cargo on those trucks. The content of the cargo is, and it's roughly 280 trucks who were originally in the convoy, 69 electric generators, 400 tons of grain and cereals, 340 tons of canned meat, 30 tons of salt, 100 tons of sugar, 60 tons of canned milk products, 80 kilograms of tea, around 679 tons of bottled water, over 62 tons of baby food, 54 tons of various medical supplies, and over 12,000 sleeping bags. On the 15th of August, according to the understanding we reached with the Ukrainian authorities, 59 Ukrainian officials arrived at this crossing point. Of course, the peculiarity of the situation is that on the Russian side, the crossing point is controlled by our border officials and our customs officials, but on the Ukrainian side, it is the self-defense forces, the local people who are controlling the crossing points, that particular crossing point. Therefore, the arrangement was that the Ukrainians were, Ukrainian officials were arriving at on our side of the border. 59 of them came on the 15th of August, and they could immediately start checking the checking the cargo. And that work was actually proceeding. And in the course of all those days, we had numerous contacts and exchanges at various levels with the president of the International Red Cross, with the representatives of the International Red Cross in Russia, and with the Ukrainian officials. And also, we were trying to be as transparent as humanly possible in other places, including here in New York. On the 7th of August, I informed the Secretary General about our intention to send that humanitarian convoy, and the Secretary General welcome it as a good gesture. We announced that intention on the 8th of August, I believe, at the meeting of the Security Council. Unfortunately, as you know, some of our colleagues chose to play politics with that, even though normally here in this building you hear people wanting humanitarian assistance to be delivered. For some reason, in this particular case, they were trying to do everything in order to create political obstacles to the delivery of that humanitarian aid. Anyway, it became clear to our people on the ground yesterday and this morning that the Ukrainians keep procrastinating because their border guards who were on the spot and who were supposed to give the green light to the convoy kept saying that they had no orders to allow the entry of that humanitarian convoy on the Ukrainian territory. And in a situation when there was and continues to be a pressing need for that humanitarian assistance, and some of the goods which I have described are perishable goods, particularly the food for children, a decision was taken, and we told the ICRC and the Ukrainians, I think, on the 20th, that we cannot wait much longer. So if they keep procrastinating, we'll start moving. So the convoy departed. And again, as I say, according to media reports, the first trucks already reached the city of Lugansk. We hope that ICRC can participate in the distribution of this humanitarian assistance in Lugansk. They told us they might because there are some ICRC people on the ground, and also the Russian Red Cross is planning to participate. I don't know many technical details on the ground, but this is the general nature of things. So we believe that this is something which needs to be done, and we hope that it will provide help to those people who are urgently in need of that assistance. But, of course, that does not change the dramatic situation in eastern Ukraine. The shelling and the fighting continues. Russia calls for immediate and unconditional ceasefire. Unfortunately, the Ukrainian side, the Kyiv authorities, have not accepted that.
And now an update on the situation in Ferguson, Missouri. First, journalist Caleb Maupin, who's been on the ground in Ferguson since the protests began, spoke with us Friday about the events he witnessed Thursday evening.
Well, yesterday at 3 in the afternoon, there was quite a big crowd that was gathered at the site where the killing took place. There were a lot of forces there that were really trying to discourage people from protesting or engaging in any activity. It became clear to me yesterday that literally millions of dollars have been spent to send people into the community in Ferguson to urge people to stop protesting and stop being in the streets. Literally millions of dollars have been spent. However, the people that I spoke to that were gathered at the site of the murder, they have a will to fight. Despite everyone urging them not to and all that, they have a will to continue being out in the streets. Two people I spoke to told me that they said the only reason anyone knows the name Michael Brown is because of the looting. They said this would have just happened on its own if it hadn't been for the protesting and for the looting that they did, and that while all this money is being spent and all these people, including people from the Oprah Network, Eric Holder, ministers from around the country are all coming in urging people not to protest. They say if they hadn't gone out and protested, no one would have cared.
Right. So there's an understanding of that on the ground. That's good.
There really is. There's a real will to fight on the part of the people, which is really amazing. Because there's no one here telling them to fight, you know.
I won't say spontaneous, because at the basis of it are some long-standing grievances, but the eruption perhaps is spontaneous.
Right.
What about the planning? There were a meeting that was supposed to go on where people were going to figure out what to do next. What's going on along that line?
Well, it's kind of gotten chaotic. There was some hope that there would be an actual planning meeting about the next step, but that the meeting people were hoping for didn't happen. Now there are various planning meetings being set up by various churches. There's a woman who has a network on the Oprah, or has a show on the Oprah Network called Change My Life or something like that. She was here and she set up a committee of 13 that she declared to be the representative committee, and there were all kinds of meetings going on, and it was chaos. There was a big crowd that went out last night. I'd say 500 to 700 people, and the police really kind of stood back. I think they're getting direct direction from federal officials about how to proceed.
Right.
And one of the big things that made last night different was that they weren't going up to the crowd. They weren't kind of jostling people and giving people trouble. They were very much distant. There was huge armored cars and all of that. All of the guns, all of the stuff that we saw on the first night was there, but it was out of sight. It was around the corner. and they tried to kind of keep the hands off, and the police were much less intense. On the first night I was there, the police, you know, if you so much stood still, they would run up to you and tell you, keep moving. Well, today the police were kind of out of sight, and there was a hope that they could kind of quell the tensions by kind of backing off a little bit, and then letting these forces that have been brought in, these forces associated with the Democratic Party, and other outfits that are urging people to not protest, and let them do their work while the police aren't there.
Has anyone of these outside forces that are coming in talking about systemic change, which is at the bottom of the unrest?
Again, like, these forces that are being brought in are actually, they're urging people to trust the courts. Right. Some of them are pushing kind of a nationalist message, you know, urging people to buy black, urging black businesses to open. But the message of the forces that have come in is that the rioting and the looting, that hurts everything, and that you got to trust the courts, and you got to give Obama a chance, and I mean, these forces are being brought in with lots of money coming in, and they're there to quell the fighting. Many of them are religious, not all of them, but they're there to urge people not to do anything. And they make arguments such as, they say things like, well, by going out and protesting, you discredit the message. You discredit Michael Brown. You make him look like he was a thug or something like that. And they're telling people, you know, you need to make people think that Ferguson is a community with sensible people, and sensible people don't go out to protest. They've accused the people of protesting of being selfish, saying, oh, you know, you just want to feel good and riot, but if you really want justice, you'll stay home and let the courts do their job. You know, it's kind of disgusting, some of the forces, but the community seems to be quite hostile to them.
That's interesting. I mean, and again, the irony of it is those people are only there because of the protests in the first place.
Exactly.
What's your prognosis looking at what's happening there, like, over the next few days? They're treating it like there's been a steady, like a diffusion of the tension or whatever, that, you know, the air's being let out of the bag and things are going to go back to normal, quote-unquote. Is that your sense of it?
Well, what I heard from people when I was interviewing people on the ground was everyone said that it was starting to swell a little bit. However, if the officer is not charged, if they announce that officer is not charged, that city will be burned to the ground. Everyone said if they announce that he's not charged, that there will be an explosion and it'll be bigger than anything we've seen yet. That's what everyone said to me. And I got to tell you also, just quickly, yesterday when I was at the site, I went to the site of the murder of Michael Brown. They have in the middle of the road set up a shrine or thing. It says hands up, don't shoot. It's got a whole bunch of flowers and things. Mm. And at that site, you know, I was able to talk to a number of people who directly live in the neighborhood. And one of the most, you know, kind of tragic moments was that there were some kids who just kind of play in the neighborhood, you know, 3 or 4 years old. Mm. And while we were filming, there was a girl who was like 4 years old. She walked up to me and she said, "I know why you're here. You're here because of that guy that I saw covered up on the street." You know, and basically this 4-year-old girl was telling me about how she had looked out the window and saw the corpse of Michael Brown.
Oh, man.
It was very, very intense.
That's terrible.
And something else that occurred was that the people that live in the neighborhood have calculated that it's basically cost the city, the police forces that have been involved in all the tear gassing and the National Guard and all that have come in, they spent over $6 million. Mm. And one thing that was said is, you know, if they could have spent just $1 million on giving people here some jobs or some economic opportunity, you know, things like this wouldn't be happening.
Right. That's right. Because $6 million, that's a small community. It's like 20,000 people, 25,000 people, right?
Right.
Wow.
But instead, there was $6 million spent on shipping police in from out of state, making tear gas weapons, armored cars, guns, bombs, you name it. But when it came to, you know, the actual needs of the people, which is the, you know, the underlying aspect of all this was economic.
Right.
They said one of the main jobs in the area is home health care workers. So there's a lot of home health care workers in the neighborhood there. And home health care workers aren't paid very well. It's a very, very low job. But they said, interestingly, the neighborhood, it's called Canfield Development, I believe.
Mm.
Canfield, which is the neighborhood there, is actually considered to be one of the better neighborhoods in Ferguson. You know, there's people there are employed. One thing that was also told to me by people there is that one aspect of the community in Ferguson there is that everyone has guns. It is an armed population, very much so. The people there very much feel that they have to have guns for their safety, and that almost every family is in possession of firearms.
Despite an ugly history that began with slavery and included Jim Crow, segregation, COINTELPRO, assassinations, mass incarceration, and stop and frisk, to name only a few, public expressions of dissatisfaction by African Americans with their status in this country are almost always blamed on outsiders, denying this group of oppressed people even the right to their own agency and standing up to fight their own oppression. It's an old story, one that also held sway back in the 1960s, when then FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover, discussing urban uprisings in July of 1967, had this conversation with then President Lyndon Baines Johnson.
Yes, I just got word that Martin Luther King will give a press conference at 11 o'clock this morning in Atlanta. Now, the statement King is to make will differ very greatly from what Roy Wilkins has said and what Whitney Young has said, and will, in a sense, condone the national result from the inhuman conditions that the Negroes are forced to exist in the country. King was told by Levinson, who is his principal advisor and who is a secret communist, that he has more to gain nationally by agreeing with the violence that is coming out against it, as the president is afraid at this time and is willing to make concessions for it. King said that the worst has not yet happened in this country in such places as Cleveland, Oakland, and Philadelphia. King referred specifically to Chicago and said they gave me the plan today in Chicago. They don't plan to burn down the West Side. They are planning to get the Loop in Chicago. That's the substance of information. We got that highly confidentially over the technicals.
The sudden media focus on the decades-long militarization of the police in the U.S. has ripped the cover off of one of the country's longest-running wars. That's the war on Black America. Black Agenda Radio's Glenn Ford offered this commentary.
The brave and besieged people of Ferguson, Missouri, have already caused serious complications for the U.S. national security state. By virtue of simply standing their ground in their own small city, the demonstrators have forced the local, county, and state police to show their true, thoroughly militarized colors. Ferguson's righteous agitators and rebellious black youth have succeeded in pinning down, in one small space, the armed forces of racist repression in full view of the corporate and the people's media, so that the whole world can bear witness to the truth of what another generation proclaimed nearly half a century ago, that in the black community, the police are an army of occupation. The military character and mission of the police is more clear today than when the Black Panther Party and others sounded the alarm in the 60s. Back then, the first SWAT teams were staking out sniper positions on city streets, and the Federal Law Enforcement Assistance Administration had only just begun to funnel millions of dollars in surveillance technology, guns, body armor, and all manner of lethal equipment to local and state police departments across the country. The term mass black incarceration had not yet been coined, but it was only a matter of time before a permanent, militarized police offensive against rebellion-prone ghettos would cause unprecedented numbers of black prisoners to flow into the greatest gulag in the history of the world. The powers that be, every day of the year, make it crystal clear to black people, especially to black men, that an overwhelming and lethal force is prepared to crush them for any reason or for no reason at all. This is the definition of a war of terror. By refusing to disperse, the black people of Ferguson have compelled the police to flaunt their military nature and mission before the eyes of the world. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Glenn Ford.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.